Morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. This morning, our first case is United States versus Metz. Lieutenant Wester, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Westacar, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, Wester, please begin.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Urban, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Michael Wester, and I represent Corporal Bradley Metz. Chief Judge, with the court's permission, I request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Correct.
Agent Perry said he had some information presented to him that he needed to figure out what he needed to do with. Well, his way of figuring out was to put Corporal Metz in handcuffs, knowing that he did not have probable cause, and bring Corporal Metz to where he suspected evidence would be found. Because this illegal arrest tainted the evidence that formed the basis of the charges against the appellant, the evidence should have been suppressed, and of course counsel should have filed the proper motion. In Brown v. Illinois, the case the lower court failed to apply, the Supreme Court established 3 factors that govern whether evidence obtained after an illegal arrest like this one warrants suppression. First, the temporal proximity of the arrest and the evidence obtained. 2, the presence of intervening circumstances. And 3rd, most compellingly, the flagrancy of the official misconduct. In Brown, the court stated that arrests that are done knowing that probable cause was lacking, in the hope that something might turn up, most strongly warrant application of the exclusionary rule. And that describes the arrest that took place in this case. Agent Thompson said the agents did not have enough evidence to get a search authorization. She said there were many reasons why there could have been a gas smell on appellant's shoes. Likewise, Agent Perry said he did not have probable cause, and this is at the suppression hearing. So he went to look for appellant after the agent's investigation apparently hit a snag when he was not at his door. Agent Perry said he went to look for appellant down in the courtyard, and he offers a variety of different reasons for why he ultimately decided to put handcuffs on appellant, none of which I submit met the definition of a Terry stop. He said appellant didn't seem to respond like I think someone appropriately would when I called out to him. And another time he said, the most important thing was I just didn't like his behavior. This is after he already had appellant remove his hands from his pockets, which he said occurred too slowly. But after that even happened, he then applied the handcuffs, told Corporal Metz he was being detained, not arrested, and then asked him if he'd be willing to discuss things up with the agents at the room. Of course, the room is where the agents had just smelled the shoes. This tainted the search that immediately took place right afterward. The agents...
Both of you seem to agree that there's a failure of the CCA to apply the Brown framework, and that should be remanded. So in terms of going through a detailed recitation of the facts here, why is that necessary? Why should we not be focusing on the legal aspects of this case rather than the factual aspects?
Well, Chief Adelson, I just for one clarification, I don't believe that there should just be a remand. The government's position is that the granted issue stated that asked whether the lower court erred in failing to apply Brown despite finding that a felon was illegally apprehended. I think that fairly encapsulates the court's conclusion as well. The court's conclusion, of course, in erring was that there was no deficient performance of counsel. The evidence was admissible. So, respectfully to the government's position, I think this is a case where the analysis here and getting into the facts is necessary because it's interwoven with the failure of the lower court to apply Brown. Once we ascertain that the lower court did not apply Brown, despite finding that he was illegally apprehended, it becomes clear that the derivative evidence was tainted and something should have been done about it.
Okay, I understand your point. I'm just wondering if this court were to decide that a remand is appropriate, wouldn't the CCA be wrestling with all those issues in terms of the factual issues? Wouldn't the appellant's counsel, whoever that might be, have an opportunity to flesh that out with that court? So why would this court be wrestling with the detailed facts that you're spelling out here?
Because, Your Honor, I just don't think that there's a need to do a remand in this case. I think we have a sufficiently...
Your point is there shouldn't be a remand.
That is correct, Your Honor.
That the record is sufficient in terms of the facts that we could decide this, and that it's essentially a legal issue anyways.
That's your point.
Is that a fair characterization?
That's precise.
So you're saying, don't remand it, just decide it at this level.
Yes, Your Honor, that is precisely. And we think that, without getting too far ahead, we do think that that even extends to the deficient performance of counsel analysis. There was a suppression hearing here. Counsel identified correctly that there was a problem with the agent's behavior vis-a-vis Corporal Ness. He just raised the wrong motion. So we have a developed explanation by the agent as to what was going through their mind at the moment when they apprehended the appellant, when Agent Perry did so.
Now, it's more typical, however, for our court and other courts of appeals. When you've got a situation where a lower court has failed to apply an obvious legal standard, that we remand it and let them take the first shot at it, particularly when you get into this very detailed analysis that involves a host of different issues that needed to be fleshed out, potentially, below.
I think it is common. The government did cite a prior case where this court, just on a summary disposition, determined that, Your Honor. I think while that is one possible approach, and it wouldn't be a wrong approach, I wouldn't say that, I don't think that in the interest of, let's say, judicial economy or perhaps even just having the issues fully developed right here at this court, I would even submit that might be superfluous. Counsel even explained his thought process as to what the theory of suppression was. And I think the record, Your Honor, speaks for itself here. And I don't know that a remand would really accomplish anything. Your Honor mentioned that the lower courts usually have a first chance to dig into all these facts. I would say that's what they say. They did have a chance. It was fully briefed down below. The lower court provided a lengthy opinion in which they identified numerous facts and even gave an interpretation of those facts. But their interpretation fell short because it didn't apply ground. That's where this court can then pick up the analysis and finish the lower court's work. And I think that requires, Your Honor, just further analysis a little bit as to each of the searches that took place in the space. So we have the first search where the agents then quickly ask him to, sign the consent form, which he does. They then use what they learned from that search to then ask appellant, after telling him that it incriminated him, put him back in custody and then take him to the station. And during that time, we have an unbroken chain when it comes to the Brown analysis. They're confronting him with the evidence in the interrogation. They are referring to events that happened prior that day. And then the analysis continues until the prior day when they release him close to midnight, and then they order him back the next day.
But, counsel, aren't there some holes in the fact-finding, for instance, if we were trying to step through the Brown analysis, is there a fact-finding on why the agent left the handcuffs on your client for that duration of time? I looked for it. I couldn't find it. I feel like it's relevant to the Brown factors. It just seems like there are certain holes in the facts that we not only wouldn't normally engage in fact-finding, we can't do it. Even if we wanted to, we can't do it. So doesn't that sort of necessitate a remand?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and here's why. So Agent Perry does explain why he put the handcuffs on him. He offers, as I said before, a variety of different reasons for doing so. I don't know that we need to get into every specific proper reason. I mean, it doesn't really require much more than what the lower court already determined and what the government does not quibble with, that arrest, however it may have been premised, was prolonged way past what it should have been. And that's enough for this court to conclude that that was as lower court already did.
But that's part of the problem, right? We know why he put them on. We don't really know why he left them on. Right? Beyond when I think CCA would have been, if he had just taken them off, then there wouldn't have been a problem. But he chose to leave them on, creating the issue, and which is why we're all here, right? And I didn't see in the record any fact-finding on why the agent did that.
He doesn't explicitly say that he did it. He does say, Your Honor, that he wants to get a few things figured out, and if I could quickly look to the record here, he talks about, he does say the "let's discuss things" comment. We can also look to the fact that he says, please come with us. I mean, they're going to the room where Agent Thompson has a search consent form. I mean, we don't have the agent, and I don't know that we ever will have the agent admitting that we did this all for evidence. But I don't think that's what's necessary. I think you can look at what their statements were and make that determination for yourself. And so, Your Honor mentioned also, you know, different polls or different, perhaps, gaps in the narrative. But I don't think that those gaps in the narrative, I don't even know if there are any. I don't know that they really matter here. We have, for example, United States versus Darnall, this court's most recent application of this framework. And there, I mean, we had an entire evening in which the accused was interrogated, left, and then was told by the agent, come back the next day. He goes without command escort back to headquarters, read his rights again. And so presumably there was a gap in the events there. This court didn't need to remand the case for a few days here to find out, you know, what happened here. What, you know, what was the reason behind, you know, the accused had a voluntary, you know, ability during that intervening time period. So I think that while there's not a perfect record, perhaps, there is a sufficient record based on what the agent said and just the evidence that was developed at that hearing, Your Honor. So then I just wanted to touch base. If this court were to find that, you know, at the debate hearing, that remand was necessary, I think then we have to take it further and say not just a remand, but then we really need to dig more into the facts. But I think that on that note, Your Honor, there is quite a bit that appellant's affidavit gives us along that route. So the appellant in his affidavit explains that, contrary to what Agent Perry says, that he didn't have a purpose for being there. There was a friend in the smoke pit that he was walking near, and then Agent Perry calls out to him and puts him in handcuffs after already patting him down. So I can understand from this court's perspective why that fact might be important. I don't know that it's dispositive at this point and necessary to get into. Again, there's another very important question raised in his declaration where he says that by the time of the second day, somebody in his chain of command had told him, you're not going back to your room, you know, so make sure you have everything you need. Of course, he was taken for pretrial confinement immediately after he was in NCIS's custody for that second search. I think that raises a serious question as to whether he even had authority over the room anymore, whether he had the ability to even give consent. So in that sense, Your Honor, there are facts that could be further developed. If this court decides that a remand is necessary, I would also ask that a debate or additional fact-finding be also ordered on that, because I think while there is enough here to resolve the issue, if we're going to go through the process of a remand, we may as well also get more of the facts that were developed on this issue that can more fully perhaps clarify all of the contours of what we're looking at here, Your Honor.
And in fact, it wouldn't make sense for this court to hamstring CCA in the course of its review of the matter.
This court should not hamstring the CCA, Your Honor. Again, I don't think that would be hamstringing them to decide at this point. But again, understanding the court's...
I'm hamstringing them in terms of not authorizing a detainee.
Oh, well, I think this court, Your Honor, there's a case that I did not cite in my brief. It was decided, it was a Coast Guard case this past year with a 31B issue, where I believe in the first opinion this court did order a debate straight from here. And so perhaps ordering additional affidavits could also be an approach that this court could use on that front, Your Honor, if this court believes that there are more facts necessary to develop the issue.
What is your position now? I mean, at first you were opposed to a remand, and now it sounds like, yeah, it wouldn't be a bad idea to get some additional facts.
Just to clarify, Senior Judge Herman, we don't want a remand. But if this court were to go down the path of a remand, then here would be the appellant's prescribed request in the sense of a remand. Yes.
But Counsel, can we switch gears a little bit and talk about prejudice? You mentioned just on page 59 of your brief at the end that if this evidence had been excluded, the evidence from the interrogation and the search had been excluded, there's a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different. And then the government, on pages 40, 41, 42, contests that and says, no, in fact, there were five facts that would not have been excluded and would have been enough to convict him. And you don't really reply in your reply brief to that specific point. What is your reply to the government's point that even if the evidence from the interrogation and the search had been excluded, there was still enough evidence there such that there is no reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that the government gets ahead of itself a little bit there. The government is assuming that certain facts would have come in that simply is not supported by the record. This kind of ties in with the inevitable discovery analysis. So specifically, the government is saying that that the fires were started with the same ignitable fluid found on the appellant's shoes and gloves. That's what they found from his room. I mean, so they're assuming there that the search would have been okay. But of course, I think Your Honor's question is getting at, well, if that's not the case, they would have found this no matter what. And that's not true. For example, the key card reader saying that he was in his room at 3:35, that is a direct response to his statements that he made during his interrogation. So certain facts the government is taking liberties with, I would say, assuming that those would have come out inevitably, when that's just not supported by the record, Your Honor. I think the interrogation was the centerpiece of the government's case. They had the clothing, but of course, the appellant also worked in a shop. Agent Thompson said that there were many reasons why there could have been gas in his clothing. He was involved with lawn maintenance work. He worked on his cars in the shop. There were 12 canisters of gas throughout the fire scene, is what the experienced arson investigator, Agent Perry, said. There's a reason why they reached the determination that they didn't believe they had probable cause, because they realized they were interacting with a Marine whose job was to work around fuels. They had some suspicion certainly raised, but by their own admissions, they weren't even seeking a search authorization at that point. And so I think that defeats, without speculating significantly, any argument that the evidence that the government refers to here would have come in no matter what, as to prejudice, and also similarly a claim relating to inevitable discovery.
Lieutenant Commander Wester, make sure I understand your position. Let's assume for the moment that the apprehension is the illegality. And is your position that from that illegality, the original apprehension, everything else is tainted? And let's further assume that, let's not go too far down the line, but let's assume that you get to the room and that consent to search and the fruits of that consent are now tainted, right? So what happens after that is a series of things that it's not clear what your position is. For instance, the ride back to the NCIS office. Nothing of substance is discussed in the car, is there?
There's a discussion about his disgruntlement with the Marine Corps that they then used during his interrogation, Your Honor. The lower court mentions that in their opinion.
Okay. And then when they get there, he signs a consent for a waiver of rights, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, your position is that waiver is still tainted from the previous illegality.
It is, Your Honor.
Back at the barracks.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so there is not, it's not remote enough in your view?
It's not, Your Honor, and I think that there's case law that supports this view. So, first of all, on ground, there were, I believe, 2 hours between the initial apprehension and the Miranda waiver. And, of course, the voluntariness of the Miranda waiver is only a primary question, right? Since it doesn't get to the analysis of Brown. And then when it comes to Your Honor's question, we have here also case law saying that, when the accused is confronted, and I see Chief Judge, I'm running low on my time, I finish answering the question. When the accused is then confronted in the interrogation with evidence that he's been told incriminates him, that lessens the incentive on the accused part to believe that this is truly a voluntary act.
So basically, he's at, according to you, your viewpoint is, he's at the jig is up point, right? And yeah. Now I may as well just come forth with everything I know.
That's
he
right.
Does it, though, does he? I think his statements after that waiver of rights are suspect. Some of them, apparently, isn't that where he talks about this kind of false alibi, or later determined to be a false alibi? So what fruits from the interview are you saying are tainted?
Your Honor, it's the fact that it's not just that he doesn't confess, if that's what Your Honor is pointing out. That's correct. He does, however, offer a number of incriminating statements. If I were you, I would beg me for it too. Nodding his head along when they, say that there was gas found on his hands. Things of that nature, Your Honor.
So then the next thing that happens is they send him back to his barracks for the night, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he's summoned back to the NCIS office the following morning. And they give him another rights advisement, right?
They do give him a rights advisement.
He waives his right to, well, he does not waive his rights to interrogation, right? But he does sign another consent to search, oddly enough. Right? And they go do the second search, right? And they find some fruits from that search. So, can you explain to me why you, at this point, don't believe that the second day's waiver, the second day's consent to search is still tainted from the previous day's illegality back at the barracks, the apprehension.
Yes, Your Honor. So it's a similar framework to Darnall. In Darnall, and I mentioned it in response to Judge Harvey's question from earlier, the agents left the accused alone.
Excuse me one moment. Please tell me I apologize for escalating.
So in Darnall, the agents left the accused alone for the evening. He went home. They did hang on to his cell phone. He then went back the next day voluntarily and was again advised that his Miranda rights, which he waived, provided another statement. The question isn't so much was it voluntary, because that's what the lower court already determined, and we don't quibble with that.
Right, but the question, you're right, that's not the question. The question under the Brown analysis is whether or not the government is exploiting the previous illegality. There's a whole lot of stuff in my viewpoint, it seems. There's a lot that takes place at this point, the second day, between what happened the previous day concerning the illegal apprehension.
And the only fact is,
at some point, you do get attenuated, I would suspect.
Yes, Your Honor. And, of course, that's a great point, is that when does it become attenuated? I would say here the defining point is that he's ordered back under command escort. He doesn't go back there voluntarily.
Sure.
His command comes to his room. I mean, and one of the witnesses, Kyle, testifies he saw him at the TX when he went in for morning coffee, and that said, I'm here under escort. I mean, Agent Perry said he ordered the appellant back to NCIS. This is the same agent, of course, who was involved in everything the day before. So certainly, even if it was a voluntary, I mean, the question about whether the agents were continuing to exploit what they learned from the day before, when Agent Perry himself said the reason I brought him back was to continue gathering facts for the investigation, I think is a highly relevant standpoint, a highly relevant bit of information on the attenuation analysis, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And just to correct the record, when I first referred to you by rank, I was basing that on your filing your brief. So now that you've been promoted, and congratulations.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Appreciate it.
Now we'll hear from Lieutenant Listica, unless you've been promoted to Admiral or something like that.
Not yet, Your Honor.
Okay.
Chief Judge Olson, Judges of the Court, and may it please the Court. I'm Lieutenant Greg Rustico, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Blosser, I represent the United States. This Court should remand for three reasons. First, the lower court failed to apply the Brown standard altogether. Second, appellant's ineffective assistance of counsel claim falls outside the granted issue. And third, the lower court is better positioned to order further fact-finding if needed. Alternatively, this Court can affirm, because even if Brown is applied, appellant's claim of ineffective assistance of counsel fails. Turning first to the issue of remand. In the United States Constitution...
Before we get started, I for one would like to commend you for conceding on the point of Brown. Oftentimes, counsel will fight until the last dog dies on a mission such as this when they hope to win. I think it's a teachable moment for other counsel in other cases in terms of conceding on an obvious point, arguing the alternative in case we don't agree with you, and then trying to get the best disposition. So I just wanted to commend you for conceding on that point.
Thank you, Your Honor. So turning to the issue of remand, ultimately the issue of remedy once this Court finds error. In United States versus Sperling, this Court was confronted with a very similar situation. The lower court analyzed a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, but it failed to apply the correct legal standard. And thus, what this court did was send it back down to the lower court to apply that test, and then if it applies it incorrectly, that's when this court, under its Article 67 authority to rule on matters of law, is best suited to make a judgment about the propriety of their analysis. We have a very similar situation here. The parties below briefed the Brown issue, and the lower court simply missed the issue. They forgot to address it in their analysis. And so
how do you know that? What if they just decided they weren't going to address it?
It's certainly possible, although they make no statement about that in their opinion, and we submit that the case law is quite clear, both from this court and the Supreme Court, that once you find an illegal apprehension, there is still a question of not only the voluntariness of the consent, but then also the attenuation.
Well, that's right. So, but that would suggest that a remand is not necessary. If the court below was presented with the issue, and it was all briefed up, and they decided, for whatever reasons, they weren't going to address the issue, why send it back? They've had their chance, haven't they?
Well, we give this court an opportunity to reaffirm that Brown versus Illinois analysis needs to be conducted, and so then the court...
I can do that from here, can't we?
In theory, you could. It's more of a question of what's most appropriate, and I think it's...
What is appropriate about this court deciding the issue that the lower court, having been apprised of it, did not?
Well, for one, there is the potential for the need for additional fact-finding. So,
is there, in your view, more fact-finding necessary?
Well, Your Honor, it depends on...
And if the CCA must not have thought that, because they didn't ask for any more facts, did they?
Well, they didn't ask for any more facts, frankly, because they forgot to conduct the Brown analysis. But the issue is that, as Your Honor mentioned earlier, there's this kind of cascading levels of Brown analysis that potentially need to be applied here. So depending on how the first search, whether that is attenuated or not, then we get to the interrogation, whether or not that's attenuated, and then we get to Judge Mack's concern about, well, depending on which items of evidence are excluded, then the strength of the government's evidence and whether there would even be any prejudice from the failure to file this motion. And so at this stage, we certainly don't believe more fact-finding is necessary because we believe the Brown analysis on the first consent is enough to show attenuation. And I can talk about that a little bit later. But ultimately, we believe that the CCA should be given an opportunity to at least address this issue.
You had an opportunity, though. You just told us that.
Yes, Your Honor. Ultimately, the CCA is made up of fallible human beings just like you and me, and I think they...
Yes.
such as me. And frankly, there were a number of issues briefed at the lower court. I think there were at least six AOEs, I may be mistaken. And so they just simply overlooked it, I believe. And so, similar to as this court did in Sperling, Baer, Du Bois, this court should simply send the issue back down and give them an opportunity to address it.
All right. Well, on that point, looking at the briefs before the CCA, oddly, it seems like the government thoroughly briefed Brown, and the appellant cited Brown but didn't fully address the argument. Should we make anything of that in determining whether they had an opportunity? And it's odd because the government's brief certainly goes through Brown, but the analysis in the appellant's brief is not very thorough.
Yes, Your Honor, there's certainly an aspect in which this court should avoid giving appellant a windfall at this stage. So to appellant's credit, he did identify a legal issue in the opinion, and he asked the court whether or not that was an error. And that question was whether or not Brown should have been applied. He didn't ask about the content of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And Your Honor is correct. The issue, the government briefed it up thoroughly, but appellant didn't give it much attention. And frankly, we believe that if the CCA had given it the attention it deserved, there's a lot of case law talking about how you need to look at both voluntariness and attenuation, but that the two are nearly coterminous. It is theoretically possible to have a voluntary consent, but not attenuation. But here, there's no reason to believe that there wasn't attenuation. And so we don't believe they should be given a second bite at the apple. Because if it goes back down, Your Honor, I guess to clarify, we don't believe any further briefing would necessarily be needed. It's simply that the CCA would be given an opportunity to take a look at their opinion and frankly, just amend the opinion or add to the opinion their Brown analysis.
Without additional briefing?
We don't believe it would be necessary because we briefed the issue. That's a decision for them to make. If they think more briefing is necessary, that's certainly within their purview. And that leads to my second argument for why remand is necessary, which is that the granted issue here is narrow. I know the court is aware, but the question here was, did the lower court err by failing to apply Brown? And the parties agreed that the answer to that question is yes. Similar to other cases, such as Simpson or Guardado, this court certainly can go beyond the scope of a granted issue, but I believe this court has done the right thing in the past and should continue to hold the parties, whether it's the government or appellant, to the questions that they ask this court.
And you kind of buried that point in footnote 1 of page 14. So I think that's a little bit curious. But in response, appellant's counsel says the Brown framework analysis and this IAC issue are inexplicably linked. Why are they wrong?
What appellant gets right is that the Brown analysis occurs within the broader ineffective assistance of counsel claim. But what's missing is the question that is asked here today is simply, did they err by failing to apply Brown? And that question, you can answer that question without ever touching under what context Brown is being asked, whether it was something that was linked below and were an abuse of discretion standard, or here, where it's being raised through an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The idea is that the question that was asked here is a discrete one. And we have other cases such as Firth, where appellants ask this court, was my counsel ineffective? But appellants chose not to ask that question to the court here today, and so, frankly, the issue is easier. It's smaller than it could have been, and that's just simply a choice that was made in the context of the litigation. And then third, another reason for that remand is appropriate is that, frankly, the lower court is better positioned to order any fact-finding if necessary. So, as Judge Sparks mentioned, there are a number of factual questions that could arise depending on how the Brown analysis plays out. And one thing we haven't heard from is trial defense counsel. And I'd be remiss if I didn't respond to appellant's claim in reply that we don't need to hear from trial defense counsel. The United States is unaware of any case, and appellant doesn't cite any case, where an attorney's comments that are made on the record while an attorney-client relationship is still in place are considered an explanation of his tactical choices. The ineffective assistance of counsel claim severs that attorney-client relationship, and now the privilege is gone, and the trial defense counsel can defend himself and explain his reasoning. We simply don't know what the trial defense counsel knew. Perhaps he had spoken to the agents and knew more about the inevitableness of this discovery, or perhaps when he spoke to his client, his version of events were different than what we've gotten here in a declaration. Those are the kind of issues that the CCA can wrestle with once they get an opportunity to hear from trial defense counsel. If this court is inclined to address the substantive issue, we do believe that this court can simply affirm because the CCA's error of not applying Brown created no actual prejudice because the Brown analysis does favor a finding of attenuation. As the court in Brown, which established the...
Where would you cite the point of attenuation taking place? Given the timeline that I discussed with the defense counsel over here.
Your Honor, it occurred when appellant was given an opportunity to read, initial, and sign a written consent form for his room, the first consent.
Okay, so you're saying that the consent, after having been presumably illegally detained and apprehended, was the intervening event that separates or attenuates the illegality from the search of the room?
Well, Your Honor, as you're aware, there's three factors under Brown, and we don't believe that there is temporal distance or intervening circumstances. Ultimately, goes to the flagrancy or the lack of flagrancy, the lack of purposefulness of the illegality. So other cases such as Brown, where they break into an individual's home, they point a gun at him, even Darnall, which appellant cites to, a taser was drawn, the individual was handcuffed for much longer, transported to spaces, his phone was seized in. Here we have what the lower court called an extremely brief extension of what was otherwise a lawful Terry stop. And so we don't have the kind of flagrant misconduct that the Supreme Court says the Brown test is meant to deter. As the Supreme Court mentioned in the Utah versus Street case, for the violation to be flagrant, more severe misconduct is required than the mere absence of probable cause for the seizure. That's ultimately what we have here. We are conceding that he should have taken him out of the cuffs as soon as he had completed the pat-down. And he didn't. And as the lower court said, it lasted seconds to maybe a minute longer than necessary. And that's unfortunate. But that is not a poisonous tree that is so large to cast a shadow over the next 24 hours of consent to search, consent to interrogation, consent to search again. And the contention, Your Honor, that that the first search somehow, or that brief apprehension somehow influences decisions later, as we mentioned in our brief, appellant actually stands firm in his claim of innocence. This isn't a situation like Shetler or Jones, where an individual is induced or coerced into confessing based on evidence that were poisonous, right, the fruit of the poison tree. He makes a decision to give a false alibi and to stand by his innocence.
So again, your position is that the agents were not exploiting the illegality of the detention at back at the barracks when they asked him for consent to search his room.
Right. As the lower court, this court mentioned in Conklin, there the illegal search was, quote, the only factor that led to the request to consent. That's not the situation here. As the lower court mentioned, appellant had twice at this point welcomed the agents into his barracks room. He had been willing to talk to them. They had a consent form ready to go, which is why they were going to find him in the first place. There's no evidence that he was in some way resistant or not compliant and that they used the handcuffs to somehow cajole him into getting the consent. There simply isn't that causal connection, exploitation, as Ron had mentioned. If I may, in the time remaining, I'd like to address one of the questions that Judge Maggs asked about what the government's record or evidence might look like depending on how the Brown analysis turns out. And the United States disagrees with some of appellant's characterization of the facts. So in a world in which the evidence from the first search is suppressed and even the interrogation is suppressed, the government would still have had evidence that the fire was started by ignitable fluids and that there was no sign of force entry. That those same fluids were found on his shoes and gloves, and I'd like to clarify for the court, his gloves are found during the search the second day, and his shoes were placed out on the railing outside of his room, and so, frankly, they were abandoned property that NCIS could have seized at that point. So those items are coming in, even if we lose the first two searches. We know that the fire started at 3:35, and then he returned to his room at 3:36. And we can quibble about whether the agents would have ever looked at his key card reader, but he had clearly become the focus of the investigation. The agents had a defined list of key holders, and they had chosen to talk to him. They'd seen the shoes that smelled of fuel. They were focused on him, so there's no reason to think they wouldn't. Next, we would have evidence that he lied about losing his key, because that was during the initial interaction, not just the interrogation, that he said, I never left my room, so we have this false alibi, and he says, I lost my key. It was during the second search that those keys were found hidden inside a tissue box in his room. We would also have evidence that he was frustrated with the sergeant, the very sergeant whose gear was found placed directly on top of the fire, and we would have the evidence that the other key holders all had alibis. So, again, we don't believe that the court needs to get into that analysis, that, frankly, the most appropriate remedy is simply to send it back down and let the CCA conduct the Brown analysis. But I felt necessary to address those factual issues.
You mentioned just something briefly about the accused shoes left out on the walkway between the barracks, right, along the barracks, as abandoned property?
Or at least it's placed out into a common space. It was no longer in his barracks room.
Oh, yeah? Have you ever looked at that?
No, Your Honor.
Well, I think people in barracks would be surprised to hear that when they put things outside, that it's abandoned for anyone to come along and take.
Sorry, I misspoke, Your Honor. I simply meant that the law enforcement could have seized it.
I understand. I
apologize. Any further questions, the United States requests that this court remand to the lower court with instructions to apply Brown versus Illinois.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. Can this first response?
Before you start, can I ask a question? Why should this court incentivize CCAs not to address legal issues? It's a principle of economics. If you reward something, you will get more of it. So why should this court do the work
that the CCA was supposed to do? And why would that not result in an increased incidence of these types of things happening?
Yes, Your Honor. And I don't profess to have a great answer to Your Honor's question, other than perhaps judicial economy here. If they had, an opportunity to address it, and they didn't. And here we are, you know, 3 years after the trial. I would probably just stand on that argument, Your Honor. Now, with response to Judge Harvey's question, I think JA-92 kind of gets to all these posts I would submit is we're going to get that explanation of why he kept the public handcuffs. He says, more importantly, I just didn't like his behavior at that point. So I did approach him and tell him, hey, you're making me real nervous now. We want to talk to you some more. But I did control him briefly. And then on JA-219, he says, after the appellant removed his hands from his pockets upon being ordered to do so, trial counsel asked, what happened after he took his hands out of his pockets? Because of where I was and my comfort level, I placed him in hand irons briefly. I explained to him why. But he was not under arrest. He was being detained. And we would like to talk to him some more. And he agreed to go with us back toward his room. I think therein lies two statements. He wants to talk to him some more. Agent Thompson is waiting at the room with his search authorization. We know that the agents, if they ever had an officer safety concern, it had been dissipated at this point. The purpose was to talk to him some more. They used the handcuffing as a way to get there, knowing that they didn't have probable cause. Whether we could say that was purposeful, flagrant, it was certainly unwise, as this court said in Darnell. Thank you, Your Honor. Any questions?
Okay. The case is now submitted. The court thanks Lieutenant Commander Lester, Lieutenant Lustico, for your arguments in this case. And this court is now recessed until 10:45.